Next case on the docket is Tony Jacob Thomas versus Commonwealth, Mr. Howard and Ms. Brooker.
Good morning, Ms.
Good morning. We'll give you a minute to get settled in. And Mr. Howard, you're going to have 15 minutes. Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, ma'am. May I reserve 5 minutes?
5 minutes for rebuttal it is, sir. Yes, sir.
May it please the court, Brooke Howard on behalf of Tony Jacob Thomas here today on his appellant brief. Court's indulgence, let me. I'm ready when.
You may begin.
Thank you. I apologize.
That's okay.
Sorry, it's only my second time in front of the Court of Appeals and first arguing. So it's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate the court's consideration today. I'd like to kind of jump right to the meat, if you will, of what I believe to be the primary issues in this case, and moreover, the two cases that are most similarly situated. I would submit that the actual meat of the issue in this case would be one of first impression. However, I think there are similarly situated cases. First and foremost, that of the Lewis versus Commonwealth, 295 VA 454, and also Sandy v. Or Commonwealth v. Sandy, rather, 257 VA 87. And I will start by way of a little brief factual recitation, and I know that is in the written.
And you can assume we're very familiar with
yes,
the facts.
Yes, sir. Okay. Yes, sir. I thank you, Your Honor. So I'll jump right to the Lewis case, and in particular in Lewis, the significance here, because of course, my first assignment is essentially surrounding the idea that the court never accepted what would have been the proposed guilty plea of Mr. Thomas. In the interim, circumstances arose that caused the Commonwealth and Mr. Thomas to renegotiate that plea agreement. And because it had not been accepted, certainly not adjudicated, but I would submit not even accepted by the court, that reversing what was ultimately the misdemeanor assault and battery plea agreement, that was improper conduct. And I want to.
So the court, though, had taken it under advisement, correct?
Yes.
So what does that mean to you in terms of what's the legal effect of the court taking something under advisement?
Yes, sir. So I would submit that because of some of the procedural, there were some procedural matters that were improperly done, and the court could not, because of those, take it under advisement. First and foremost, Your Honor.
So if you don't believe the court could take it under advisement, why not go back to that particular judge and say, Your Honor, based on this, that, and the other, we don't believe that this was properly before the court, and we'd ask you to do X, Y, and Z.
So, Your Honor, by way of, I appreciate you asking that question. By way of the factual scenario, because it is somewhat unique by way of COVID, when we tendered what we, what I call in the pleading the first attempted proposed plea agreement, that was heard on January 22nd of 2020. Of course, we all are very familiar with what occurred after that. At that immediate hearing, a lot of things ultimately happened in the interim, but at that immediate hearing, the proposed sentencing and acceptance of the plea agreement was set over to April 20th, 2020. And obviously, as I said, COVID wasn't necessarily on the radar on that January date. Very shortly thereafter, it was. What ultimately occurred, we have had in our jurisdiction for quite some time, or had a substitute judge, Judge Herman Wisnett. And he was prior to Judge Plowman being his investiture and being appointed. Judge Wisnett and Judge Parker were kind of our two primary judges. And I only bring that up in light of your question to state that we started receiving call. Our clerk advised not only myself but other defense attorneys in the local bar that Judge Wisnett was instructed the clerks to ask around, if you will, and if anyone had agreements or any kind of agreed orders, agreed plea dispositions, anything like that, to submit, that he would be happy to entertain those. And
but you already had something pending before another judge.
That's absolutely correct. If the court were to take the position that he had properly taken the proposed plea agreement.
Well, it doesn't matter. Regardless of what we call it, you won't dispute that there was something before Judge Plowman that was pending.
Without question.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
And was Judge Wisnett made aware of that pending other than as an attachment to some pleading? Was that discussed?
Yes, ma'am. And I appreciate you asking that question. And in particular, it wasn't only discussed, but it was pled, because the way that the time frame kind of played out, Commonwealth and I agreed to amend the proposed plea agreement. And significantly, on May 8th of 2020, that is when we set this hearing with Judge Wisnett for what would have been the entry of the proposed amended plea. Now, because I felt that exactly what Your Honor is stating, that this is a unique situation, and it absolutely was presented to Judge Plowman without question, I filed a bond motion as part of the appendix. I filed a bond motion for that date to be heard on that date if necessary, that actually attached a factual recitation of what occurred on January 20th.
That's a bond motion. That's not the second plea.
No, ma'am, but functionally, I did it that way, and I actually attached the transcript from the January 20th hearing to it because I wanted to make the court, and I wanted to put something in the file and file something that made it unequivocally clear that Judge Wisnett was totally and completely aware of what had occurred and what had been presented to Judge Plowman on January 20th, 2022.
Now, Judge Decker is far better at asking questions than I am, but I really got the impression that her initial question to you was, at the hearing before Judge Wisnett, was he or a tennis informed of the procedural posture of this case and that it up till that point was under advisement before Judge Plowman?
Yes, sir. Of course, indulgence. May I get a brief sip of...
You can bring that with you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Your Honor, to answer that question, I cannot immediately recall exactly what was said, every single word of that particular hearing. If I recall...
But that's a big issue, whether or not he was informed verbally about the procedural posture of this case and that the matter had been pending before a different judge and was taken under advisement. I mean, honestly, the logical inference, and clearly what Judge Plowman found, and it's easy to see why, is that if he wasn't informed of that very significant issue, it's because the parties were trying to avoid being in front of Judge Plowman on that.
And Your Honor, that was not, and that let me be absolutely clear, that was not at all the case. But for Judge Wisnett, again, through the clerk's office, kind of reaching out and by reaching out.
But he reached out generally about agreed issues. He didn't solicit you all to
before
him.
No, sir, not all. This was general. In fact, there were multiple cases that multiple defense attorneys at multiple firms submitted because of the clerk saying, look, Judge Wisnett is here and he's willing to entertain anything that is agreed. There was absolutely no motive, intent whatsoever to work around Judge Plowman. There was none of that. No, sir. If Judge, whoever this was, we would have filed this and we would have proceeded this way whoever the judge would have been. It's just by virtue of the very unique situation with COVID, and because, again, the very unique situation of the clerk saying, we have a substitute judge who is here and willing to entertain agreed dispositions, that's the only reason it was in front of Judge Wisnant. We were in no way, shape, or form trying to avoid Judge Plowman at all. No,
counsel,
sir.
Just to be straight on it, the plea agreement, the second one, specifically does say that there had been one previously proffered on January 22nd, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. I drafted that once again, in addition to the transcript that I attached to the bond motion that recited what occurred on that January date. I wanted it to be unequivocally clear that there was no attempt, because I did recognize that it could be taken that way, and that was not the...
And the bond statement quotes from the prior hearing, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
The plea agreement does not specifically say that it was taken under advisement by Judge Plowman.
The original plea agreement?
Yes, sir. No, the amended plea agreement. Doesn't say that this matter, as it stands, is currently under advisement.
I don't believe it did, but again, that would... I apologize, Your Honor. I don't believe it did, but again, because I would assert that there were some issues with how the arraignment went on that January 20th date, that he could not have taken it under advisement because my client was not properly arraigned on what would have been the properly amended charge. So, no, it did not. It did not.
But at no point on the day that Judge Plowman took it under advisement, did anybody suggest that he couldn't do what he was doing? As a matter of fact, you all asked him to do that at that point in time, didn't you, by being before him on that date?
Your Honor, so actually that was, I recognized, actually said in open court, I recognized that he was attempting to arraign my client pursuant to the plea agreement. And I said,
conditionally, basically.
Essentially, I said, well, Judge, what are we doing? Are we going to amend it, and are you going to accept this proposed plea agreement or not? And he said, no, we're just going to. In fact, I picked that page out in particular. Quote, Judge Plowman stated, quote, we will set a date for a sentencing or acceptance of the plea. Because if for some reason the plea, I don't know what the terms are or anything, but if the plea is, if the court does not accept the agreement and rejects it, your client will have the right to withdraw his plea.
And was there any suggestion at that point in time that, Judge, I don't think you have the authority to do it this way? Or was it, yeah, let's go ahead and set it?
No, sir, it was let's go ahead and set it over. That's true. And, again, at that point in time, the factual scenarios that gave rise to the Commonwealth and I going back in and renegotiating the plea arrangement had not yet come to pass.
Well, a big part of the issue on the negotiation, as I understood it before the court for the initial plea agreement that was presented, where the Commonwealth said it had witness issues.
For the Commonwealth did have witness issues as to one of the witnesses. That's correct. The other witness, the other
said,
issue...
I think it said one had criminal issues that it was contending with. And the other one had, I think at that point in time, had just been admitted to the hospital for respiratory.
Yes, sir.
Issues.
So at the time of the original proposed plea agreement, the one witness had the severe health issues at the hospital. The criminal issues surrounding the other witness had not yet come to pass. They came to pass, which is why the Commonwealth and I entered in back into negotiations. After the Commonwealth and I said, can we even do this? And we took a look at the case law, and I said, yeah, I think we can. I don't think he ever accepted the plea agreement that day. I don't think that happened.
But what does it mean to you when a court takes something under advisement?
If it is properly taken under advisement, in other words...
Well, and I don't think we need to diverge into a discussion of approbate and reprobate, but you all were before the court, and by virtue of assenting to what he did, you certainly weren't in a position to complain about whether it was lawfully under advisement or not, because both of you assented to it at the time and didn't ask him to change that position before going before another judge. So assume for the sake of argument that we as a body of three for this panel would view it as properly under advisement before the court. So what does it mean to you for the court to take something under advisement?
Your Honor, I believe the current state of the law is that, yes, if something is properly under advisement, there, and part of that is a proper judgment of, well, not a judgment of conviction, but a proper arraignment at, pursuant to Virginia Supreme Court Rule 3-8. If there is a proper arraignment and the proper steps are taken to thereby accept the tendered plea of guilty and then take it under advisement, I believe it's under advisement. And at that point, it is in the discretion of the court, without question. I understand what that means.
Is your position, if that had happened in this instance, you would not have gone to Judge Wisnett?
Well, let me kind of be clear, Your Honor. We did not go to Judge Wisnett. We did not go.
Well, you went with another to another judge with a second plea agreement.
We did. We did. But that only at the again.
It feels like you're playing games with that. The question we've already established: Judge Wisnett did not solicit this case specifically.
Yes, sir.
Made a general solicitation. You all accepted that general solicitation by going before him. So I think that's Judge Decker's question.
But in that context, let's assume that everything happened the way you think it should have happened in Judge Plowman's court. Would you have still gone forward with the second agreement to a different judge?
I don't think we could have, because I think if there hadn't been the issues with the arraignment and how it had proceeded on that day, January 20th, I don't think we could have. No, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you. Well, we've used up a good bit of your time, so we're going to give you a minute on rebuttal, even though we've used up your time.
That's okay, Your Honor. I know the court's
busy. No, we're happy to give you a minute because we took it. So.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
Good morning again, Ms. Brooker.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, again, and may it please the court, Lindsay Brooker for the Commonwealth. In looking through the record, there is no oral information to Judge Wisnett given about the fact that there was a plea agreement under advisement.
And what was in the what information about the prior agreement was given to the judge?
The information that was given to the judge in writing was the line in the plea agreement. And then I went back, there was the transcript attached to the bond hearing, and I knew there was something in the transcripts about the timing of that, and I found it. It's during the show cause hearing that Judge Plowman administered on May 27th of 2020. It's record page 773, when Mr. Howard explains to the court that, you know, I did file a bond motion. It's part of the back and forth of, well, how did this even get on the docket when we weren't doing in-person hearings? And it's explained that it was filed, and then the Judge Plowman notes, well, the bond motion was heard the same day you filed it. You filed it in court, so you were coming to court with that, and it was set before you even filed it. So whether or not this transcript attached the bond motion was something Judge Wisnett was meaningfully able to consider, given that it wasn't filed in advance of the hearing day, it was filed on the hearing day, I think is very important. Had this bond motion been filed maybe a week before with this transcript, I think it would be reasonable to assume that the judge would have time to review a multi-page transcript and be ready to address that at the hearing. But the timing deprived Judge Wisnett from being able to meaningfully consider it. And I think if this truly was out of an abundance of caution and this very strange circumstance that everyone did find themselves in as a result of COVID, then making mention of that on the record of, Judge, I know you've probably just seen this morning, but in full disclosure, there's another plea agreement out there that has not been ruled upon by Judge Plowman, would have been the appropriate means to inform the court and let Judge Wisnett make an informed decision about whether it was appropriate to go behind that agreement or whether it would be appropriate to move the hearing to Judge Plowman for consideration.
And I'm not necessarily disagreeing with anything you said, but you agree the bond request motion was filed on May the 8th.
Which was the day of the hearing, yes.
The day of the hearing,
okay. Yes. And that's why. It absolutely was in writing. It was in that motion. The transcript was attached. But the first time the parties are before.
And it says the fact that the plea agreement was offered but never accepted by the court, and it says in a couple places that the court, paragraph 3, it says the court referenced multiple times throughout the hearing that the court was not in bold accepting the plea and would take up the issue of accepting and or rejecting the same at the next hearing, and cites 10 pages where that happened. I don't know if they're accurate or not. I mean, you're not saying that he didn't try at all. You're saying there was a better way.
Correct. I am not saying that information was not at all available to
Judge
Wisnant.
Do we know from the record whether that bond motion was ever actually before the second judge?
It was filed the day of the hearing, and then Mr. Thomas had not been transported, and so the hearing itself took place a few days later. But what happened at the hearing was they entered an agreed bond motion, or bond order. But I don't believe, and I could be wrong, but I'm fairly certain the bond order only makes reference to the conditions of the bond until that next plea date. It doesn't reference that there's another plea agreement.
So Judge Wisnant was never tasked with litigating the bond motion?
Correct. It was presented as something that was agreed. And he had some clarification questions about, well, kind of, why are we doing this and how long will it last? Because you're telling me you have this agreed plea to a misdemeanor, and then the agreed order is entered.
But he kept referencing that second agreement, not the first agreement.
Correct. His reference, they were brought before the court on May 8th with the idea that they were going to be doing a plea and sentencing.
Right.
But because Mr. Thomas hadn't been transported, that sort of converted into a bond hearing with an agreement that he would be on bond essentially until the following Wednesday. So it's just a few days, and then they came back before the court with the plea agreement. And I also think, because you see from the transcript, there wasn't really the same full colloquy between Judge Wisnant and Mr. Thomas as there was between Judge Plowman and Mr. Thomas, because now it was a misdemeanor, and it doesn't have the same requirements under 3A:8 as a felony plea would have. And so, again, I acknowledge that the bond motion made reference to the fact that there had been a plea that had not been ruled upon, and that the plea agreement referenced it. But I don't know that the record's clear that Judge Wisnant had a chance to read any of those
documents.
In
the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, isn't the reasonable inference that when an agreement's presented to the judge on the very issue that that motion concerns, that there would be no need to review the motion?
Yes.
I think. And its attachments.
Yes.
Can we jump back to Judge Plowman and the curious nature of whatever he did with that plea agreement? I mean, it strikes me as a very strange hearing. And what is the Commonwealth's position on the status of that plea agreement at the time that Judge Plowman continued the case?
So the Commonwealth's position would be that the plea itself had been found to be knowing and voluntary. The facts had been found sufficient for a finding of guilt, but Judge Plowman had continued the case, taken it under advisement to consider whether the plea agreement was appropriate, and if he determined the plea agreement was appropriate, he would enter the finding of guilt at that time.
Do we have any case law where there's a situation where a plea where you accept the facts, you accept plea is entered into knowingly and voluntarily, but instead of holding it and continuing it and holding it in abeyance until such time as you do the sentencing, that you also hold the guilty plea itself or the finding of guilt?
So, Your Honor, I couldn't find a case that was squarely on point with this one. I think the issue of what can a court do in a situation where the plea has been found to be knowing and voluntary but hasn't been officially accepted is a case of first impression for this
court. In which case, if it is, under the statute, can't a defendant withdraw the plea at any time?
So prior to sentencing, under 19.2296.
Well, this is prior to a finding of guilt.
This is prior to, for the official entry of the finding of guilt. The court has found that the facts are sufficient for a finding of guilt. So it's a little bit different than a case in which sort of everything
is under advisement. That's an anomaly, as far as I'm concerned.
It's a very unique set of circumstances, and I would acknowledge that, and I spent a lot of time trying to find something similar and came up short. The cases that I did cite on brief, I think, do support the fact that the trial court has the ability to take a plea and then take the agreement and the ultimate entry of the finding under advisement. And in this case, it also makes sense that the court might want or need to do that, given that the original plea that was presented and the proffer of facts indicated that this was a charge of aggravated malicious wounding in which the victim was sliced across the face with a razor-style knife and was being amended to unlawful wounding, despite the fact that he had permanent injuries and side effects from this injury, and that the plea agreement that was proffered to Judge Plowman was going to involve constraining his sentencing discretion because it also included an agreement that Mr. Thomas would be sentenced within the guidelines. And so under the specific facts of this case, I think there are different ways that the colloquy could have gone, but I think it's important to note that everyone agreed with those proceedings.
Right. There was no objection.
Correct. And at any time, Mr. Thomas, who was represented by counsel through the duration, he wasn't pro se at any point in time, could have said, Your Honor, this is inappropriate. We don't feel comfortable with this happening the way it is. And so if the court wants time to review the plea agreement with the proffer that you've now had and continue this case for the plea colloquy and acceptance, that would be fine. That was never offered to the court. There was no objection. Everyone agreed that we could proceed in this way. And Mr. Thomas made it very clear that he understood that what he was doing was entering a knowing and voluntary plea to an amended charge of unlawful wounding on the condition that the court ultimately accepted the plea, that he was not entering a plea to the original aggravated malicious wounding charge. He was entering a plea to the unlawful wounding charge and would be able to withdraw that plea if the court did not accept the agreement. He would be back at square one and free to either exercise his right to trial or renegotiate a different agreement and present it to a different judge.
And if that's the case, and there's language from Judge Plowman saying, well, the reason I'm doing this is because if I don't agree with this or that, he can withdraw it. Did he implicitly withdraw it when they filed the second plea agreement in front of the second judge?
Did he implicitly? What he was obviously saying was that I no longer want this agreement. I think you can't implicitly withdraw a plea that's been entered. I think you need to explicitly do it.
Well, it hadn't been entered, arguably.
He's in an awkward situation because he has to move to withdraw a plea that hasn't been accepted, right?
Well, it hasn't been accepted, but it has been found to be knowing and voluntary. And so I do think the appropriate mechanism would be to file the motion to withdraw. And again, whether that was filed in front of Judge Wisnett or Judge Plowman, I think alerting the court that we are in a unique spot where a plea has been entered. It has not been accepted, but it has been entered. It's not been accepted. So in an abundance of caution, because we've reached this new place, we are asking the court to allow us to withdraw the plea that you haven't made a decision on in that agreement and present this new one. I think that would be the appropriate mechanism given the unique facts of this situation, because it's not that the court had rejected it or it was still active. It was still being considered. The case was before the judge for his ultimate consideration, and I think there is a difference between a plea agreement before it's been presented to the court and a colloquy has been undertaken versus when the parties are still in the negotiation piece, like in the Sandy case. There was a negotiation, but no agreement had ever been presented to the court. And then there was litigation about whether the Commonwealth still had to honor the plea agreement, given the immunity and cooperation agreement that the defendant didn't hold up his end of the bargain. And so in that case, of course, the facts were distinguishable because nothing had been presented to the court.
And based on the posture of the case, it would seem as though what's contained in paragraph one of the amended plea agreement that just refers to as a previously proffered plea of guilty seems very misleading to actually what did occur and the status of the case as of that moment in time.
Exactly. Previously proffered could be read many ways. It could mean previously proffered and rejected, and that's why we're before another judge. And it could mean previously proffered and under advisement, but it's not clear. And I think that's what cuts against Mr. Thomas's arguments in this case.
And proffer of a plea of guilt almost sounds like, well, counsel would be saying, well, he's willing to plead guilty under such circumstances versus a plea that was actually made and simply taken under advisement, not yet entered.
Yes. And I think that that's the concern in this case, that the way the colloquy was unique, it absolutely was. But because of the uniqueness of the colloquy, I think that requires additional explanation to the court in navigating the case forward. And at no time did Mr. Thomas make a motion to withdraw his plea until Judge Plowman had vacated the orders that Judge Wisnett entered. It wasn't presented as a motion to withdraw the plea to Judge Wisnett. There was no motion to withdraw the plea after Judge Wisnett honored the second agreement and amended the charge to a misdemeanor and gave Mr. Thomas that benefit. It's not until months later that then Mr. Thomas comes back to court and says, now that you're considering the original agreement, I said I wanted, I signed the paperwork, I went through the colloquy, you found my plea to be knowing and intelligent, I don't want it anymore.
Well, but those same arguments can be made against the Commonwealth in the second plea. I mean, y'all agreed to bust it down to misdemeanor assault and battery, and you did it on purpose. And I understand that you're not bound, but it's awfully hard to say they're approbating and reprobating by agreeing with us, isn't it?
I think that the Commonwealth obviously should have taken a different position because it's the Commonwealth's ultimate burden to make sure.
And don't get me wrong, I'm not trying, I mean, I understand that, but for purposes of approbating and reprobating, it's awfully tough, don't you think, to say by going along with the Commonwealth, you did wrong. I mean, both parties did the same thing. It's an agreed plea agreement, right?
Yes, both parties presented that agreement, and I think that that was not a correct decision. I think that did not honor the Commonwealth's obligations to be candid with the court and to ultimately make sure the integrity of the judicial system is preserved.
Is it fair then to punish only one party?
Well, arguably it would be punishing both because this behavior was ultimately found to be gamesmanship, which is something that was separately litigated between Judge Plowman and both attorneys. So there was...
Well, there was no impact to that. I mean...
Correct. No one was ultimately sanctioned.
There were no sanctions. There were no requests for sanctions. The judge didn't find either in contempt.
That's correct.
He just was annoyed.
Right, and essentially made it known that he believed both parties were responsible for what had occurred, that it did not rest with Mr. Thomas. I see I'm out of time. If there's any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them. But if not, I would ask the court to affirm.
Thank you, Ms. Brooker.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Howard.
We're
going to give you a minute, sir.
Thank you. I just, in light of the back and forth as far as Judge Wisnett's knowledge, it's significant that May 8th, 2020 hearing where the bond motion and order were submitted, that was not the hearing at which the plea amendment, and I'm going to read from a portion of my motion and also the order that was entered on that day, that was not the date that the plea was entered.
But
it was actually.
But the bond was an agreed upon result, correct? You all agreed.
Bond was agreed, but a motion was filed. Yes,
sir. I understand that, but having been someone that sat on the trial court for time, I'm just trying to figure out what the point would be if you all present him with an agreed-upon bond result that he's going to go back in thereafter read the motion and its attachments.
I see the court's point with that, absolutely. In practicing in
doesn't it make it all the more important then to make sure that you give him the proper context of how this case came to be
in
at all, less much less in front of him?
Yes, sir. My response would be more centered around practicing around Judge Wisnett for a decade, and that is that it is well known that Judge Wisnett reads everything that is put in the court's file. And by function of that and function of that kind of working knowledge that I had, that was my purpose of putting in the bond motion itself a whole section titled case posture and history before.
Why wasn't that information included in the second plea agreement?
Your Honor, I believe we just didn't think that it would be necessary because we were amending it over, and I will...
I mean, in the history, wouldn't that be important in the history portion of discussing why a violent crime was being reduced to a misdemeanor?
Yes, ma'am.
Along with the fact that a witness was, you know, no longer available and all that information?
Absolutely.
I know hindsight's 20/20, and you know, don't get me wrong. This was a horrendously difficult time in history for lawyers.
Yes.
With COVID and with everything else that was going on. So I fully recognize the difficulties surrounding that period of time.
Yes, ma'am.
And
I would state, directing your attention to the amended plea agreement, provision one, the parties agree to amend the defendant's previously proffered plea of guilty.
But he didn't proffer a plea of guilt. He entered a plea of guilt. It just hadn't yet been accepted. It was taken under advisement.
And again, Your Honor, that would go back to my position that he was never properly arraigned. And so I don't think without a proper arraignment.
I understand that, but you may have an entirely different invited error or approbate and reprobate issue with that.
Yes, sir.
But you didn't say in here that he was arraigned, but improperly so, despite his entering a conditional plea of guilt to unlawful wounding. It's just a proffered plea, and at no point did he proffer a plea. He entered a plea.
Well, and Your Honor, to your point, that's exactly why I decided to attach the transcript from the hearing to the bond motion. And again, in the continuance order from May 8th to the 13th, included in that, these cases came to be heard on amendment of the entry of the plea to continue for sentencing and bond if sentencing be continued subsequent to the amended plea, pursuant to the motion to request bond pending sentencing filed by counsel for the defendant. So I was doing what I thought from a procedural standpoint to make that imminently clear to the court, and not, in fact, not wanting to take any legal positions one way or another at that particular time. That is why I felt it appropriate.
You drafted the plea agreement, didn't you?
I did. In anticipation of that, I ordered, went through the expense. I've represented Mr. Thomas pro bono this entire time. I went to the expense of getting a copy of the transcript to attach to review to make sure we were doing everything within the bounds of the law, number one. And number two, to attach to the bond hearing to make sure that that was in front of the court. And that Judge Wisnett did see that. And so the position that he was unaware, I would submit is without merit for two reasons. Number one, if you practice in Fauquier County for any significant time.
Except that up here we're not considering
I understand, yes, sir.
Anybody's colloquial practice.
Understood. The second, that between May 8th and May 13th, there was that time period where Judge Wisnett, and not only that, but the bond motion was filed. It was filed that day, but I can't speak for Judge Wisnett, obviously, but I believe it.
When was the bond agreement presented to him? Was it also that day?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So there seems to be very little to consider when it comes to bond after May 8th.
That's true, but the bond motion was filed ahead of the hearing.
Yes, sir.
And I...
Ahead of that hearing, but that day, that
yes,
morning.
Sir. Yes, sir. Correct.
What happened on the 13th?
Your Honor, on the 13th, the amended plea agreement was presented and entered in by virtue of it being a misdemeanor now and not a felony. There was no formal colloquy. There's no question about that. However, the plea agreement, I would just, again, going back to that plea agreement, I would state that included a couple things. Provision one, parties agreed to amend the defendant's previously proffered plea of guilty on, notwithstanding, I know Your Honor's exception to that, but just the language of the document presented, on January 22, 2020, in accordance with and pursuant to the terms, conditions, consideration, and mutual covenants set forth therein, that based on the same, this amended plea agreement shall supersede and govern all aspects of said previously proffered plea of guilty. and then that the Commonwealth shall amend the indictment in this matter to reflect the charge of misdemeanor assault and battery pursuant to VA Code Annotated 18257.
Does it say in there what he previously proffered his plea of guilty to?
So that is the significance, Your Honor. I'm glad you asked that question. That's the significance of my position, that it was just a strange hearing on January 20th, and we didn't really tender a plea, because I would submit to do that. The original indictment...
But everything I'm seeing in the amended plea agreement refers to either assault and battery, that is the Second Amendment, or aggravated malicious wounding. And there's just simply a generic reference to a previously proffered plea of guilty, but it doesn't say to unlawful wounding. It doesn't say to aggravated malicious wounding. It just says previously proffered plea of guilty.
Precisely correct, because it was never amended to unlawful wounding pursuant to what the agreement was.
But the plea was entered to unlawful wounding.
A proposed plea agreement.
And a colloquy was done with unlawful wounding in mind.
I would submit.
But
you
stipulated
cannot,
sufficiency to that charge. It was taken under advisement at that point in time. There's no getting around the specifics of what was covered in January.
No, sir. I mean, the transcripts speak for themselves without question. But I would submit that without an amendment from malicious wounding, which is 18251.2. PCC code ASL 1336-F2 over to unlawful wounding, which is 18.251, PCC code ASL 1335-F6.
Well, if you're not going to give the full history, then why even put in there a previously proffered plea of guilty if it's of no legal effect?
Your Honor, I at the time, by way of ordering, submitting the motion for bond with the case posture, as well as attaching the transcript of the January 20th, 22 proceedings to that, I was under the impression that that's exactly what I had done, is give Judge Wisnett all the facts in case he felt that it was not appropriate ultimately to do what he did.
Thank you, Mr. Howard. We gave you extensive time over so that you could answer.
My apologies for that. I was not.
So that you could answer some questions.
I apologize for that.
No, thank you
for that.
Thank you very much for the court's consideration.
And before you leave, sir, under the assumption that you will be in front of us again in other cases, I just want to warn you about something. That maybe this was the first time you were in front of the court, but I know that you had some problems with your opening brief and you had to amend.
Yes,
and
ma'am.
I think the Commonwealth appropriately pointed out that you exceeded the scope of what a reasonable amended brief would be. So in the future, please beware. Okay?
Absolutely, and I appreciate the court's consideration.
Thank you, counsel.
We'll be hiring Richmond for that from here on out. Thank you.
All righty. Thank you both. The case is now submitted to the court.